Welcome to So Farscape,
a Farscape fan cast by a fervent fan
and a fresh-faced first-timer.
I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay, and this is
The Story So Farscape. Oh, we did it right that time.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, so The Story So Farscape. Yes. We have the American astronaut John Crichton,
who is still failing to do what he says in the intro: look for a way home.
Yes, he's still not tried.
No, nope, he's like, not done anything.
In the first episode, he sort of asked, "Hey, do you got any maps?" And then nobody said anything,
it's not come up again.
You have star charts.
We have Dargo, the Luxon warrior, Tentacles, yes, as you call them. We have Zan, the pacifist priestess. Eren, the peacekeeper warrior, on the run from her own people.
Yes. I mean, the guy's crazy anyway, as we hear about in the intro.
Insane military commander.
Who is like, yeah, I mean, he would like see whatever she did as defection, even though it was really involuntary on her side.
He pulled some bureaucratic nonsense, like, oh, there are strict guidelines about exposure to alien.
Oh, that was it.
You've been irreversibly contaminated, remember?
Irreversibly contaminated.
It's a little bit Japanese, isn't it? When you go out into the West for too long, then you're like, you'll never make it very high up in the hierarchy anymore. At least that's the way how it used to be. It's like if you had got contaminated by
the
West.
And you've got gaijin cooties.
Pretty much, yes. I mean, you could still like be something, but you would never be CEO again because, like, you know, you'd been like too exposed to the foreign ways of thinking, I suppose.
Well, speaking of reattaining your previous status, that's the problem that Rigel has. He's the Hynerian who has been deposed from his seat as Domino.
To over 600 billion people.
Though I still wonder how much of that was for reals and how much of that was just in his mind.
And see, it wasn't just me, right?
Yeah, no, it's like it could still be bullshit. But I mean, even then, it was like 100 years ago already. I think 100 cycles or something that they mentioned.
I was deposed over 100 cycles ago.
Very good. You've been paying attention.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we're watching this too.
I know, but I watched it in the 90s, and I had to rely on forums and everything to get me this level of geekery that you've been... I'm very impressed.
You said he was a geek.
After last week's, when the noodle heads were like giving Crichton future visions.
Yes, that's right. It's not space this time, it was time.
Which caused for a very confusing episode. I mean, they pulled it together pretty well.
It's a bit of a staple of sci-fi shows, right? The time loop episode.
Right, but it was done very well. It's like, you're sitting there wondering, okay, this could be actually what's going on, especially at first. First few times you go like, oh, you get a little bit caught off guard by the fact that like, oh, it's just a vision. And then after a while...
Because it could be psychic as well.
Right.
So I was going to have some transitional material that this week's episode is also kind of about a time loop, when you think about it.
In a way, yes. But not a literal one.
But before we get to this week's episode, I kind of want to address like what you said, like Crichton has not taken any pains to really find a way home at this point. But none of them have a plan.
You got a plan?
Plan?
Did you say plan?
What plan? What are you talking about?
Reverse course.
We leave here now.
No, this is very true. They're kind of just coasting and like just doing Planet of the Week at this point.
Yeah.
And they're just like making our way in, what was it called again?
The Uncharted Territories.
The Uncharted Territories.
Uncharted Territories, that was it.
And like, how do they choose where they go? I guess away from Peacekeeper territory, but... Yeah. Are they looking for a home? Are they just waiting
for... What are they looking for? They don't seem to be wanting for anything on the ship. I mean, although the food seems to be particularly bland.
All I have to eat is food cubes.
Maybe it's just like Grand Theft Auto. They're just waiting for the space stars to die down until they can just...
Yes, for the heat level to go down.
Yeah. Prepare to starburst!
I mean, speaking of heat level going down,
oh yeah,
we have a cute opening shot of Crichton like hiding in the rafters of the ship with Dargo furiously looking for him, standing right below
Crichton!
Him.
Yes, Crichton, and it's like it's one of those sort of Punch and Judy moments where he's right behind you. Oh no, he isn't.
And one of the poor scuttlebots gets it from Tentacles.
Oh yeah. Oh, I felt so bad for that. I mean, you observed that earlier. Like that's how you show that someone's really evil, if they kick one of the DRDs.
Was that necessary?
It felt good.
They're in a lot of danger this episode, the DRDs.
Well, this episode is, thank God it's Friday again, episode 106. And it's the last of the pod episodes. Because I told you about this previously.
Yeah, yeah.
They do two episodes at a time. So last week was Rowan Woods, and this week was Rowan Woods.
Yeah.
So they were trying one more set. Okay, we'll do two more, and then we'll have them in sequence. Instead of doing like one director does the odd ones and one director does the even ones. And so you can sort of feel that it's a lot more coherent in terms of like tempo and yes. And like look.
And I also noticed that Zahn gets to go on the planet this time. And yes. It's Erin who spends most of her time on the ship, or a lot of the time at least.
Because the heat level is too high.
Aren't you hot?
Oh, yes. She's has a heatness problem. I forgot about that.
You'd think that if they wanted to stay away from the peacekeepers, they'd just find Space Dubai or, you know, yes. Addis Ababa or
and
whatever.
Then just find some sort of cool-down vest for her to wear. And
So maybe that's not ideal for her. But, yeah. Well,
in the coldness of space. Okay, in coldness of space, the biggest problem is getting rid of heat. So, again, like, you know, the peacekeepers might not be particularly suited to that because their ships have to be like extra well cooled because they can't run the risk of having a little bit of overheating.
Maybe that's really not such a problem once you've got like a Hetch drive and all the other sort of cool science that they've got. I mean, science is a big theme this episode.
There is, it is.
Uncommonly so.
And okay, so at first the scene, it confused me a little bit because we had Dargo looking for Crichton because he was in his...
very good. Keep us on track. So we start with Dargo just stomping around yelling for Crichton. And like it's a beautiful shot Crichton! Where we zoom out from Crichton's scared face, as you say, in the rafters, and then Dargo stomping around him, and then panning out to see Farscape One while he's being recorded by various DRDs, and then Dargo like flips out, and if I can't find Crichton to smash him up, we don't know what Crichton's done at this point. Then I'll smash something else,
and one of the scuttlebots gets it. Yes, and then it cuts to a scene where we see the same ranting
housemates meeting,
yeah, I suppose.
And we have a holographic head of Dargo on the table that they're all just looking at over and over and over as he's...
Which seems to be particularly interesting, and they comment on how Crichton's been hiding on the ship.
You were wise to hide as you did, John.
For 3 days!
Because apparently Dargo is having his battle rage, berserker rage, whatever it is called.
Yes, Lux and Hyper Rage that is what it's called.
Lux and Hyper Rage, it doesn't just go away.
And it ends when he mates or kills someone.
Right, and I love the smirk on Spanky Browse's face when he's when it's mentioned about killing someone.
Because yeah. Crichton asks, like, okay, so it's directed at other males. Rigel's a male.
I think, sort of.
Why isn't he, maybe he doesn't see him as competition?
Yeah. No, he knows better.
Yes. Rigel has another few very snazzy lines in that regard in this episode, where he gets to show off his perceived superiority.
So does Erin, who establishes, like, she is a species supremacist. Like, she talks is. About, like, Sebastian superiority.
I am, however, what I have always been, and that is superior.
We find ourselves among another a cousin species because they're in orbit of a planet where Dargo has gone down to the planet.
To find Crichton or to do what? It's completely unclear why he has gone there, but apparently he's been down there for a bit.
You've got to wonder how big Moya is.
This is an awfully big ship.
Don't I know it?
And apparently Pilot doesn't like have a PA system because... He landed 3 days ago, and Crichton has been unable to be found by anyone.
For those 3 days, yes.
We couldn't find you to tell you.
Which I guess is, I mean, it's a good sign that Moya doesn't have cameras in the toilets, because otherwise Pilot would have been, or...
I suppose.
Maybe they do.
Yeah.
And Crichton's been making his own arrangements. None of these are very appealing thoughts.
I just peed in the maintenance bay.
So they have to deal with the fact that the Dargo is gone, and, well... I don't know exactly why they feel like they have to go and pick him up.
I'm pretty sure they'd suggest just to leave him there, but for some reason, Crichton especially seems disinclined to leave Dargo behind.
Yes, it's Crichton. I mean, Erin just wants her prowler back.
Yes.
Which, hey, how Dargo was able to steal it in the first place?
Well, I assume that he's been given controls or...
Why would she?
True. I mean, like, Cheryl, they're a crew now, maybe? They, like, work together?
I think that would be very difficult for her.
Yeah.
Like, she comes from, like, military discipline.
True.
Oh, yes, this introduces us to the first shot of Moya's actual transport pod. It was a different transport pod than the one we've seen in the previous two episodes, which is sort of the bullet pod with the skids. This one has more of Moya's sort of ribbing on the outside.
Yes,
it's
yes,
still
yes.
sort of copper-plated.
Yeah.
I particularly liked that as you saw the shot of it leaving Moya, like it reversed and then it turned like it was backing out of the driveway.
Yeah. So, down on the planet of the ski hat people, I mean...
Hold on. You're going to have to run that by me a few times.
So you know, just like back in the 90s or in the noughties, like there was this typical thing of ski hat, which was like a headband.
Yeah, like a sweatband.
And on top of that was like a mop of fake hair. It was either dreadlocks or just like a bunch of spiky hair.
Fake hair?
It was like, it meant to look like you had a head of hair that you didn't have and you were wearing a headband.
Hair, whatever.
And it's just like something that all these people here were wearing.
Amazing to me. I had no idea that this was a thing.
Yeah, it's still a bit of a thing. You can still see them in ski resorts and stuff. And it looks like someone's wearing like a headband and dreadlocks. And it's just a hat that they're wearing. And these people were all over that. They all have the same spiky, dreadlocky white hair.
A whole new world has just opened up for me. This is wonderful because I'm a big hat guy. And like, I like my curly hair. But if I could have spikes I didn't know that was an option.
And it comes in different colors. And on this planet, it's all white. And everybody wears red, and everybody's looking a little bit happy and dreamy and like sexy smiles at each other, including Dargo, which was very disconcerting.
Yeah,
I would say.
We see him laugh for the first time.
He's got this coy little grin on his face, and he's just like, oh hi.
He's got a lovely laugh, I've got to say. And he's wearing like fresh pajamas.
Yes.
Which was hard to tell because they're maroon, just like his own uniform.
Right. I didn't catch on to that at first either.
So they land on this planet and they follow like the stream of people to, I guess, a nightclub where they like to play Bhangra.
What's Bhangra?
It's like an Indian sort of dance music.
It's like a nightclub, and the drink stations are just like hoses at which people like come one again, like take a few gulps, taking their turn.
Bhangra bongs.
Oh, that was a very good one.
they see all these people, and they're sort of red skinned. Crichton observes that hey, they're Sabbatians, right?
They're Sabbatians.
Like they look us.
Oh yeah, so like the kissing cousins.
Oh, yes, they may be distant genetic cousins there again. And, kissing cousins, maybe.
Well, there was a lot of kissing. Well, there was actually a lot of kissing going on, but it was like a lot of implied kissing going on. Let me put it like that.
You're right. It's one of those 90s sci-fi, the planet of the sexually liberated people where we show them just smiling at each other.
Right. But
while being sexy, but not actually.
I mean, the whole vibe immediately for me was like, is this the planet of the brain drain drugs, you know? Especially with the hoses and everything and everybody being so like,
You cottoned onto that really quick. Yeah. Like this is the Lotus Eaters.
Right.
Right from the 12 labors of, was it Hercules or was it Odysseus?
I don't remember. I'm not very good in my classics.
Dine on a lotus and then you lose all your troubles.
Have this good food.
So you were really clocked into how this episode was going to go from a very early point.
I think like Dargo gave it away for me most. Like his like immediate change of heart and not just like giving up on his hyper rage, but immediately like just being like all pleasant and sexy smiles.
It's so very good to see you.
Which is like so out of character for Dargo.
Yes, he's got the dumb sort of grin on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of out of character, like this is the world gone topsy-turvy, because I remember when it was my turn watching it for the first time, I didn't clock in on any of this. Like I thought maybe this was just how hyper rage goes. I mean, even Crichton observes,
this is the end of hyper rage, I get hugged to death.
Yes, when he gets smacked down by Dargo at first. Yes.
I didn't have an idea what was going on. Now, it was 1999, and I had never had drugs before.
Oh, yes. That makes sense then.
That may have been a factor.
And Dargo's got himself a girlfriend.
Girlfriends plural, I would say.
Oh, I mean, everybody's very friendly towards each other, but there's like seems to be one that he's like keen to take home with.
Yeah, they are sort of eye-fucking each other across the bar.
But then again, everybody's eye-fucking each other here. It seems to be like the big celebration because tomorrow is the arrest day.
Arrest day.
Arrest day.
Arrest day.
Yes, they've ended the work cycle and they're having a big old rager.
And everybody's having a good time and tomorrow's the day off and...
Well, not everybody's having a good time. There is one person there who seems to be sort of faking it. She's a woman in white.
Right.
And she's unlike the rest of the people on Sykar. Like, she's got white skin. Yeah. Oh, actually, I say that. And now I'm looking at a picture of her. Her two guards, the sort of Kraftwerk devos with the red goggles. Yes.
They looked so familiar to me. I was like, I was trying to picture them. What do they remind me of? And it still hasn't occurred to me what it is. But there's something
I know exactly what you mean. So they've got the black cowls and they've got like red visors.
Yes.
And like... I was going like Devo, Kraftwerk, like something in that way.
They look like they're bishops from a chess set. You know, that's exactly what they look like. And then, of course,
they look like the little Lego spacemen that you had for a while with the red helmets.
And then, of course, there's the Wraith Borg Queen.
Okay, so you've mentioned that you recognize a few actors, and that may have been because your household watched Australian soap operas, possibly?
I guess, I mean, the only Australian soap opera I ever watched was Flying Doctors, so...
So this woman, Volmay, that's the woman in white that we're talking about, is Angie Milliken, and she's a bit of a theatre rock star in Australia.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is why she got away with... I mean, she made some bold choices for her character.
I am Volmay.
She speaks very slowly.
Yes, and with like Shatner-esque pauses.
Weird. And like she blinks one eye at a time, which is super...
Oh, I haven't noticed that.
Oh, it's so weird
but
to look at.
It would help with the disconcerting appearance that she is clearly cultivating. And she's got these weird, they're not dreadlocks, but they're like tight braids.
I see what you mean. She's got the white people dreads.
And she's got like super red eyes. It's like, oh, you've been at the catnip, lady.
So, yeah, she's kind of inverted from all the rest of the Sicarans
that we've
seen.
Yeah.
She addresses these newcomers, because apparently Sicar doesn't get a lot of newcomers, despite the fact,
no.
Like, they're in a pretty huge, like, cube-shaped city in what looked like a sort of a pastoral wilderness. Like, the way that these people are dressed, which is all of these, you know, like, loose fabrics, like, vests, lots of exposed skin.
Vietnamese farmers, like you see in Vietnam War movies.
Like, practical working clothing, loose pantaloons. I remember reading an interview with the costume designer who tried to approach the costumes of different species from a sort of logical point of view.
Yeah.
Like in this case, okay, well, a little bit of a spoiler. We know that a lot of these people are working out in the fields.
Right.
And apparently, like this species tans maroon.
Oh, okay.
That's why everyone is red versus like Volmay is also Sicaran. She doesn't go out in the fields. She stays inside.
Yeah, and she's completely white.
Yeah, she's got like almost translucent skin. You can see the veins. You can see this sort of honeycomb mottling as well, like these circular spots of texture, maybe like scales. But yeah, everybody else turns red. And in cultures where a tan is cool, you want to show it off and you wear white, versus in cultures where a tan is kind of an indicator of lower status, you wear colors that sort of match the tan to hide it. So here, everyone's wearing red, which is sort of... bleached by the sun as well.
Right, but it seems to be like not just a fashion choice, but more of a cultural thing as well, because like later on the other... The heroes of the show also get offered red clothes.
It may be a status thing, because she's got white skin and she's wearing white clothes.
Yeah.
And all of the laborers, which is basically everyone, are wearing red. And her Kraftwerk guardians, they're wearing black as well.
And you've got black and red.
Yeah, and you've got some people out of the paddies wearing black hats. Wow, we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Okay, so Zahn does this beautiful greeting with her.
I am Pa'uzotar Zen.
This is John Crichton, Aaronson. And His Eminence, Domina Rigel XVI.
Yes, she does the two hands up, does Volmay, and then she comes in with a two-handed swipe.
Kind of like swoops it together and rubs it all over her, and like I'm engulfing myself in your presence or
anointing
something like that.
Myself with your glory. Yeah.
It was a very beautiful thing. And I almost thought at that point that she was also a priestess of the same order as Zahn was or something along those lines. But I don't. That never materialized. So I guess this must be some sort of different cultural greeting. I think that's a
really interesting, like, either there is some kind of like universal greeting gesture that people understand, or, which personally is my theory, when you meet someone that's clearly of a different species, you make the best effort gesture that you have for welcoming, which is usually like open hands, is pretty universal.
Yeah.
And then you accept whatever they do,
and you kind of copy that. Yeah.
Try to integrate it, because like Crichton gives the peace sign. He gives two fingers up. They have a little chat with Volmay, the woman in white, who
welcomes them to the planet.
It is a pleasure to welcome you to Sicar.
Please stay as long as you want.
Eat, drink,
be merry.
Yes.
For tomorrow is a rest day.
Ah, yes.
Now, Aaron is a little suspicious.
She gives me a Woody.
She gives me a Woody. That's what she says.
Oh, yes.
Volmay.
Which gets corrected by Crichton into the Willies.
She gives you the Willies.
It's like, which I thought was a brilliant, like, completely misgrabbing and still staying on the same subject.
Exactly. I mean, I bet this was an American writer who didn't understand just how funny it is to British and Australians,
where,
who would take a Willie over a Woody any day of the week?
I mean, it's like, two different states of matter, I would say, but...
Yes. Oh, very scientific method of you.
Yes.
I guess this is Aaron's first exposure to the scientific method.
Well, he's going to get a lot more of that.
Yes, and speaking of getting a lot more of that, that's Dargo. He gets tempted away by his two...
His girlfriends.
Lady
yes.
friends, and says, tomorrow I'll show you all around, because it's...
Tomorrow is the big rest day. Yeah. There's some unintelligible announcement, at least for the viewers.
Yes, they've got the productivity PA.
Yes.
And the party just shuts down.
Yeah, everybody goes home. And everybody's fine with it. And
Crichton observes that that's a little weird. This must be a primitive planet.
Definitely a simple people. They never heard of the last call.
Dargo disappears with his girlfriends, and Zahn and Crichton are grabbed by the girl we will later learn is called Tanga, I believe.
Oh, very good. I didn't even have her in my notes.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's got sort of Mad Max hair. She humps him against the wall and tells him, whatever you see, whatever you hear, don't leave.
You must stay.
Which is kind of in line with what they've been told by the Borg Queen, who's also said, like, stay, you know?
Yeah.
So at that point, I was, like, sitting there, like, okay, so what's going on here? It's like, are they, like, working together? Are these two sides of the same coin?
Right.
Is there something going on? It's like, I was really, I wouldn't say I was confused, but I was like, okay, yeah. Wondering about where
there's
this was going
hook
to go.
There.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
There are two people who can't stay, which is Erin, who, like, she can manage this heat while it's night.
You're right, as long as it's night.
This is night.
And, of course, Rigel, whom gets an attempt on his life is made.
The bastards are trying to kill me!
Yes, he's feeling a little ill after having indulged in the bar.
He's been stuffing himself. Like, the first part, like, in the bar, he is just eating
he's
and eating
always
and eating.
Eating.
Yes.
And he staggers off, and I was reminded of one of my favourite songs, The Scotsman, wandered off into the grass.
Ah, yes. Well, in this case, while he's relieving himself,
he lifts his kilt and, yeah.
Yes. But there's an explosion, and, like, Rigel is completely distraught.
A bomb! Mere henters from where I was hovering. A bomb.
Explosions all around him. Aaron observes.
Why would they want to kill you? They don't know you.
Yeah.
There's only people who know you who want to kill you.
And she offers, since he's also not well and unsafe, she's going to take him up to the
back to
Moya,
the ship. Yeah.
Which sort of completes, like, all her priorities. Like, she's got herself out of the heat, she's got her prowler back, which is important to her. Hopefully yep. she'll lock it this time. And meanwhile, John and Zahn stay behind to see what's up with
Dargo.
Look, Woodstock has done something to his head.
No, this is not normal behavior. He's so content and happy to stay there.
I mean, he did get to mate, I suppose, so that makes sense that could have got the hyper rage out of him. But yeah,
so they're not too suspicious. That's right.
So apparently they ask around a bit and they show up at Dargo's apartment.
Now, you stand out amongst your neighbors.
Which has been provided to him by the state.
You have your own apartment. It's nice.
It is provided.
Feel free to sleep here on the floor. And
He's always gone Cirque du Soleil going on in his bedroom. He offers them the floor.
Ooh, yeah, very good point. And there's a long drawn out scene where Zahn is standing behind a screen undressing, and I'm just like, how long does it take for her to take that one dress off?
Yeah,
she's done it in seconds before, and yet there's like a minute long scene where she's like undressing and
yeah, and also she's comfortable with nudity.
Exactly.
It's fine with her. I guess she's doing it for his sake.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, he's still not very comfortable. He says, oh, as soon as he realizes, oh, you can have the bed, because Dargo had this cool fold-out bed that comes
right.
out of the wall.
Yes.
You take the mattress, I'm good on the floor.
Don't be silly, John. You'll be cold and uncomfortable. There's plenty of room for two.
Meanwhile, back on Moya, it turns out that the Scuttlebots are getting another bit of the short end of the stick again.
Yes, there is another attack. There are explosions happening. Erin's got her pulse rifle.
Help me!
She's homing in on where Rigel is calling for help and where all the explosions are coming from.
The pilot is saying, like, okay, yeah, it's like this explosion was not related to the ship. It's something external.
Pilot is so on the ball. You notice how anytime we see him, all of his claws are moving and operating controls. Like, this is just constant for him.
And at this point, I was like thinking, okay, so Rigel's overeating is causing him to have explosive flatulence or something. There have been various jokes about his bodily functions in the past, so this is immediately where my mind was going.
See, now, I sort of rejected that hypothesis immediately, because I knew from previous experience that his flatulence is helium.
You fart helium?
And helium is
inert. True, I know.
Cannot possibly.
But still, I mean, it might have got something to do with the local
food. Oh, you think sometimes he has hydrogen farts?
I don't know. It could be. It makes sense.
That would be dangerous.
It would be.
Boom!
But it turns out that like she catches a drop of his sweat on the barrel of her rifle, and that's actually a very threatening scene where she goes like, "Don't move," and she like pokes this gun right into his face.
Right in his face.
Don't move.
Uses it as a swab to catch a little bit of the slime, and then she tosses that between two DRDs.
Yep. And there's another explosion.
Because apparently his bodily fluids
turned explosive.
Something has happened to him, and they have become explosive.
She reports this in with Crichton, who wakes up in the middle of the night and is not very communicative to her.
He was already waking up because, like, Zahn rolls over in her sleep and ends up with her hand on his groin.
And just goes straight for the crotch grab. Like, it didn't even look like casually just rolling over. It's like her conscious self. Like, I'll grab myself some man meat
and
right
now.
And
he just, like, tastefully moves her hand to the side, and then she is like, she doesn't notice, and he gets into a discussion with Aaron about this. And this is interesting, because at this point, again, she clearly acknowledges that Crichton is the scientist here.
No, I'm not the scientist.
I know that.
Yes, that's right.
So this girl's like, I need you up here, you need to come up here and do science for me.
Yeah, because we need to figure this out, and Crichton's dismissive, he's sort of tired, like no, I don't have time for this.
I've got other concerns on my head here.
Figure it out with Pilot, but yeah, like she's doing the sensible thing. She is asking an expert to perform the function that he's best at.
Yes, that he's apparently been performing in the past.
She barks again at his advice. He says that she's got to use the scanner in the med bay. He's like, scanner?
Techs use them, not the infantry.
Those have cooties. We don't touch those.
If it's not a radar on a fighter, then I'm not using any scanners.
Yeah, he shuts her off. And I've got to say, Crichton does this a lot throughout the episode. Anytime that Aaron reports in with a perfectly normal like status update and a request for just a basic debriefing, he freaks out like he doesn't have enough time, like we can't deal with this right now. He's being super unreasonable.
And in a stunning role reversal, when they wake up in the morning, Crichton has got his hand on Zahn's butt.
Yes, he's taken his sleep revenge with the butt grab and nuzzled in between his shoulder blades.
Yep.
And her response is,
"Good morning, John."
Again, she's perfectly casual. She's happy with it. She's like, she's not bothered.
Yeah, exactly. We were asleep.
Yeah.
Like, why would you be bothered by someone's behavior while they were asleep? Like, it's perfectly innocent.
They start their morning routine. And this is where my suspicions started kicking up. It's like, oh, is this like the same day again? I'd already forgotten the name of the episode at this point. So
yes, thank God it's Friday again.
Today's not a day off.
Today is the last day of the work cycle.
We see the city again from the outside, but this time in the sun, and it's kind of cool because it's sort of like
it looks like a big grain silo.
Yeah, you're right. It looks like a big
one of those.
Yeah, so it's like a funnel toward the bottom, and it's got these columns holding it up.
Yeah,
you're right. It does look exactly like that, huh?
And so people are filing towards work, and there's like weird station at which some people are picking up food and not everybody is, or at least they're picking up things from there. And
yeah, there's a lot of just food stations you could just walk by, and people like holding trays
and
I almost said trains, which we haven't mentioned either. Train car plays such a big role in the episode.
We've seen it in the background at this point, although it didn't register.
It sort of looks like a Chinese restaurant, kind of.
It does a bit,
you know. It's got the red lacquered outside and the gold filigree. It plays a bit more of a role now because we see trains moving through the fields, which is what is outside the city.
Where everybody is moving towards. There's more people like standing in the black robes, like the black hats and the darker robes, which are also handing out food packets to some people.
Yeah, people can just pick them up as they're walking past.
And everybody goes to do their happy little work day out in the field.
So Zahn follows Dargo. Crichton's looking around, and then he gets grabbed.
Yes.
By what did you call her?
Tanga, I believe she's called.
Tanga, very good. By Tanga, grabbed into the conspiracy train, which is
where everybody drops the food.
It was a bit of a Matrix scene.
Very much so. It was like
it had in the back of the car, where
wriggly worm thing which got stuffed into his belly button.
Which is, I mean, it's kind of cool because the first Matrix film where that occurs, where it's actually like a worm being extracted from his belly button in the back of the car, also filmed in Sydney.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. And he gets told, like,
and also with a white-haired woman.
Yes.
It's one of the Zion rebels. What's she called? Switch.
They suck it out of his belly button there. And
I was kind of like, I called her a woman. In the original script, she was supposed to be played by a male actor in the real world,
which
or
is where
vice
she was
versa.
Called Switch. Yeah. She was one of the trans characters. I mean, the whole Matrix is one big trans allegory anyway. So,
a really good one. Like, yeah. Smith dead naming him all the time. But yeah, so we've got Australian actors, we've got white hair, we've got a few parallels going on. The Matrix worm wiggling into his belly. Yeah.
And Zahn having a discussion with Dargo, which I thought had a bit of a weird contradiction. At first, she starts with saying, like, oh, you can't decide that you want to live here so fast. And immediately afterwards, she says that, like, oh, but deciding that I wanted to be part of the Order was a split-second thing happening. Which I thought was a very weird...
Yeah. So I actually thought that was kind of cool, that she was open-minded enough to be convinced. But you're right. It is incredibly fast. But she is snacking on these roots in the meantime.
At this point, she is eating, yes.
So that must be helping. I mean, it is actually, this is really well written then. Because it is a logical progression for her to think about, okay, she came here with the idea that Dargo, his behavior has changed way too rapidly.
Right.
And then she is reminded, I mean, she talks about how she found her faith in prison.
Yes.
She joined the Delvian Seek and tried to become a priest, which, how, by the way, do you get ordained when you're away from your planet?
Don't know. Maybe she did an online course, I suppose, like reintegration in from prison. Although it doesn't seem to be a very much a peace finder type thing.
Peacemaker,
whatever they're called.
Well, I guess if I was a prisoner on a living ship, I'd have a lot of time to self-ordain all day long anyway.
Go. Yeah. Well. Okay.
I love these conversations between Dargo and Zahn. Like, it's kind of a shame that neither of them have gotten that much to do with the rest of the characters so far. Like, this is the first time that Dargo gets to do something against his shouty, blustery...
It must be an interesting thing for the actor to actually get a little bit of a different way to play his character.
And there's a logic to it as well. Like, he observes when she said, but Dargo, you were a warrior, and he observes...
I'm no warrior. I've been a prisoner now and a fugitive longer than I was ever a warrior.
That is entirely correct.
Oh, I guess it got brought on by the weird food here, but it's still a valid point.
Exactly, which I think is so well done in this episode. Like, it is a completely logical transition, but it is, as you observed, it's way too fast. And that has to be a function of this food that they're eating, because that's what Tanga and her dad, and I guess her brother, who kidnapped Crichton, tell him that the worm protects you. And you have to eat, and the pain goes away.
Yeah.
Understand me? You must eat.
We find out later how that works exactly. But in the meantime, there's a flashback to the ship where Eren
has... Some progress has been made.
Yeah, Eren has frozen Rigel, and we get to see Rigel's woolies. I was going to say tighty-whities, but they're not very tight and they're not very white either.
No, they're sort of... it's sort of like pasted on like plaster cast.
It is,
that he's got as undies, and they go all the way up his belly.
I only noticed in the second shot that it was actually his underwear that he was wearing.
Right?
That he was not like... featureless, like, let's call it that.
These features might be on the inside, we don't know.
True. And also notice that, like, the pilot uses Eren's full name.
Eren's son.
I guess he does that to get people's attention.
Your Eminence, I beg you, Commander Crichton. Cardago.
Pal Zotto.
And we learn that the pilot is bonded to the Leviathan.
I figured that you would write that down. Yes. So tell us what you learned about that.
Well, it's confirmed that the pilot and the Leviathan have a certain bond. And it's not said anything about how this bonding, if it's only a mental bond or if it's a physical bond or maybe both. But I thought it was a very... this is the first time we learn anything concrete about that relationship.
Right, because what were your theories prior to that? Or I should say hypotheses.
Okay, I had several. I thought he could just be part of Moya, where he was just like, you know, a living interface, the ship's computer.
That could have been it. Just like a growth on her brain,
something,
like a vocal
something
interface.
Like that, yes.
Wow.
Or he could have been a symbiote, which I thought was great. Or he could have been, like, yes, an entirely separate entity who for some reason just didn't like to get out of his room or off the bridge. You know, well, it's not the bridge because it's the pilot's quarter. It's the pilot's room. Like,
oh, yeah.
The bridge is different.
We've been calling it the bridge this whole time. Apparently, it's called the command.
You're needed in the command.
Come up to command.
Our objective is the command.
This is Eren. I'm in the command.
So that one's the command, and then he's in his den. It's called the pilot's den.
So I'm leaning a little bit more towards the fact that he's a symbiote of some sorts now. A little bit like the Trill in Star Trek, where they have like these humanoid bodies, and they're like just some sort of brain bug themselves, really. so it's something like that.
And then I guess like he's Moya's worm.
Yes.
Just like,
but more,
everybody has worms now.
I got a worm in my gut, crawling around down in places where the sun don't shine, and I'm sick of it, okay? So for the moment, would you just shut up and help?
I mean, everybody has like more bacteria inside them that are not them than they have living cells that they are them.
So, yeah, that one always kind of freaks me out. But I guess like muscle cells are huge. Yes, they are. So it kind of, they have multiple cores, but they do fuse over time. Look, lots of science stuff, but this is something that Aaron sort of struggles with. Like, I kind of regret that we didn't get to see how Rigel was frozen, because he just shows up as this.
And he's just hanging there over this dripping tray.
Are you sure he's still alive?
He's in cryostasis. He should be fine.
Mm. Yes. She pokes at him and snaps off one of his whiskers.
Which remains snapped off later on, I know, because they were like, yes. The continuity did a good job on that one.
Yes, and Pilot advises her,
I strongly suggest you don't touch any of his other protuberances.
Pilot and Aaron actually have a bit of a moment there, and I didn't quite caught what happened there. Because like, the pilot confesses something that he says that he preferred that they don't know something, and it's like it remained unclear to me what it was.
So I caught that as well. I was really focused on this scene, because this is the first time that we see pilots appearing in something other than the clamshell. Like, now he's got this sort of, it looks sort of like a flower. It's got petals all around him.
Yes.
Producing a hologram of Pilot, which is just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But so I was really paying attention. Now, he talks about how when Leviathans are born with a complete data bank of scientific knowledge.
Right. Yes.
That he accesses and studies and barely understands. And okay, so that's something that he's embarrassed about, that he doesn't fully understand all of the scientific knowledge that that Leviathans have. But nobody ever assumed that he did.
It seems weird, yeah.
I mean, unless that is common knowledge, but then why wouldn't Aaron know about it when she was operating?
And why wouldn't they know that a pilot has to learn that himself as well? Which clearly shows that they have separate minds then from the Leviathans.
Right, yes, as well. But I guess that was a pilot trying to relate to her insecurity and her sense of inadequacy by sharing his own, even though he has no reason to be embarrassed about that. Nobody has these expectations of him to be able to solve advanced scientific equations.
No, it doesn't seem like his job is to fly the ship, repeat what the computer says.
yes, and her job is to do the science, because the scanner that they need to figure out what's wrong with Rigel.
The scanner is auxiliary to Moya's systems. I'm afraid I can't access it.
After the pep talk from Pilot, she actually starts making progress towards figuring out what's going on.
Yep. Crichton, on the other hand, is not. He is lying in bed. He's been writhing in illness all day long. He's been he woke up feeling absolutely terrible. He had the wibble wobbles.
Yep.
Real bad. He gorged himself on the roots that everybody's eating.
You must eat.
Eating and puking and eating and puking. And that's how a newly contented Zan and Dargo find him.
John, I've been wondering what happened to you all day.
Have you just been here all day? And Zan talks about like how cool it is to have mud on your fingers. And it's so satisfying,
and
John.
And feels so happy. And
feels so good. I'll get you some clothes, says Dargo, so we can all be wrapped in maroon. It's gorgeous.
And she does look very good in red, but even
right,
and even Crichton gets his red outfit on, because he's been told to play along. He's been told to, like, make sure that you don't stand out, make sure that you act happy, to make sure that like you smile and act like they do, and that otherwise they will catch on that you've been like you have the worm and that you're not being infected by the thing,
by the tannet root, which is what they grow there. It's in all of their food and all of their drink, and it's what makes them so docile. They talk about how the worm that they gave him,
it thrives on the toxin that is within the tenet.
Eats the poison, basically.
Yeah. So no wonder, like, he woke up with that worm inside him, craving something that was not in his body, consuming whatever else, whatever other nutrients it could get.
And he had to, stuff the local foodstuffs in him to make sure that the worm gets fed.
So he can eat that without being affected the way that everybody is, except for Tanga and her dad.
Who seem to be naturally resistant to the stuff. Immune. Which, I mean, it makes sense. Like, a small part of the population is going to be resistant to pretty much whatever you throw at them.
Yeah, exactly. And so they pretend to be Lotus Eater, and Crichton has to practice it immediately because Volme comes over. Did you notice that she does the peace sign to him?
Yeah, she flashes it back to him.
Which is, that's why I think, like, apparently you just, You make the gesture that works for you, and you accept whatever they do, and you show that you remember.
Basically, that's what, like, the whole greeting culture is all about, you know? Like,
yeah.
You show a little bit, I'm not a threat, and, like, I recognize you, and...
Yeah, remember each other's names. So I like that Volney did that.
Yes.
Crichton does... Ben Browder does a great impersonation of just... Stoner
so happy. Yeah.
College.
I'm so cool, and like yeah. everything's fine, and we're great.
Yeah.
It's just great, man. It's everything's just... It's great.
Also, the thing we also learned from Tank and her friends is that apparently these Tanets are being harvested for the Others.
What Others?
Yes.
Which we don't know anything about yet at that point.
Yeah, that's sinister.
Yes, the Others are making them. They came here and they made us grow this stuff.
Yeah, which sort of ties together what Crichton noticed earlier. Like, this city is falling apart.
The city is falling apart around them, and they just don't seem to care.
Like, yeah. Nobody's maintaining it.
No, they're just working to make the stuff.
Progress is working in reverse here.
And, I mean, we learn later from Tanga that it's not just that. It's like also the planet is going apart. The whole monoculture that they're only growing this root.
It's devastating. It's destroying the planet. System.
Yeah.
And killing the people because it's enslaving them in this way. It's all bad news. But Crichton manages to stay undercover. He convinces Volney that he's one of them.
He eats some of the food, yeah. Where she can see, and she seems like very happy to see that he's like nicely.
Yeah, she kind of made a point to make sure that right. He eats some.
Eat and enjoy.
And she asks him about her ship, and like says that like, oh, you must get the Others to come down here as well. And how big is your ship? And how much cargo would it hold? And
like. Yes. Super cash about it, yeah.
Well, she tries, let's put it like that.
And he's accommodating because he has to be. I also like his outfit in this. Like, he shows off his guns a lot.
He does. He's like back to the...
Space Aladdin thing going.
Yes.
He's got the munchies, Rigel's in his undies, and we're back to the science, and we get, the scientific instrument that Aaron's using is this cool CRT monitor.
Oh, yeah?
Did you notice that with all the...
I noticed it, but it didn't jump out at me yet.
It's got, like, rivets. I mean, in a craft where you've got, like, holographic interfaces, and then you've got this, I guess, sort of... Tandy, almost toy-like video monitor.
It hadn't jumped out at me, I must say. And it's this point where she already discovers what's going on, that there's something in the food that's being turned into explosives by Rigel's body chemistry.
To her astonishment, like she's, wait, I did it? And I just helped you do it, Pilot. And Pilot said, no.
No, Aaronson, it was you.
It was me.
Oh, it was you all along. It's like, ah.
And so she reports back to Crichton a really exciting and relevant find, and Crichton is again...
He pretty much blows her off. He's like, yeah, whatever, get here.
That's good, Aaron. That's good.
He's being a total shithead.
He is. She's done, like, amazing and, like, been on this discovery and, like, actually figured out what's going on. And,
But he's busy. Oh, I kind of like that he hid his communicator, his little
on the inside of his jacket, where he just like flaps it open, he talks into his jacket, and it's like
covers it with his hat.
Yeah.
He's being super while leaning against the conspiracy train, where he grabs Tanga and pulls her inside.
Yes, for a little one-on-one.
A little
wants to find out what's going on. This is where he finds out about the planet being destroyed and that they're just farming this stuff for the Others, and that they come back once or twice a year and collect all the plants that have been harvested, the space turnips.
I have been out in the sun all day long picking up magic turnips.
At this point, I realize anytime we see the train, there's going to be betrayal and conspiracy. It's sort of like in Game of Thrones, where you see some people walking through a garden. Oh, someone's going to get killed.
Well, or at least they're like making plans for it. Yes.
Yeah.
And Volney comes back and like talks to Crichton again.
And he does the Imhotep. It's like, oh, cool.
Yes. And she like invites him to go for a little wander around, and she so shows him some more of the space turnips. And
they sort of reminded me of Fraggle radishes.
A little bit, yes.
Also Jim Henson.
Yes.
Volney approaches him in the bar at the end of this workday because, tomorrow is a rest day.
Yes, and this part is really cemented in that, there's like they're being tiddlywinked.
Like every day is this. This is apparently how they're being controlled by the Others. And then Volney asks to talk to him briefly, and he's like, "Okay, cool,
I'll go with you.
Sure, whatever you say."
And now it's quiet for the first time. So it's like an industrial sort of corridor, and her guards stay behind, and it's quiet. She asks a little bit more about, and space is cold, isn't it?
Yes.
I hear space
is very cold. Black and cold.
Things that life here is not.
Yeah.
And it's...
And she seems spaced out herself, to be honest.
Yeah. But also really, really intense. And she walks him through a door over which we saw the Peacekeeper logo.
And Crichton recognizes it and he goes like, oh shit. Yeah.
And these huge, huge stacks and like trains of this is the harvest that they come back for every 6 months. It's peacekeepers.
Peacekeepers.
Yes.
No.
Who have done this to this planet.
Yep. And she asks him, like, how big is Moya? Can she tote this cargo? And
well, not all of it, but
so it gives an impression that Moya could hold quite a bit. And she's like figured out, like, this stuff is like, if it's valuable to the others,
it must have value elsewhere.
And she's clearly like planning on making a run for it.
Like, I got that impression as well. Like, she's in it for herself. She talks about, I don't need to bring all of it.
No, she's like clearly not interested in saving her people. She convinces herself that she's still in control, and Crichton plays along with it. But now he knows what's going on. Because he knows that the peacekeepers are involved. Then he immediately runs to Erin, who's come back down to the planet with Rigel.
Yeah, and she, again, she has very relevant information, and all she wants from him is a status update, and he just gives her clipped bullshit. Like, I don't have time. I have had a hell of a day. Like, dude, just say what happened. It doesn't take a lot of time.
Yes.
She can piece it together for you. She's the new scientist.
He does get a little grin on her face and goes like, oh, look who's Marie Curie now. And she goes like, huh?
Madame Curie, she's a scientist.
Scientist?
Yes.
More weird ass references that he really should know by now make no sense to anybody else.
No, exactly.
But he keeps just like using these Earth references. And
yeah, oh, earlier he talked about Mad Max, that when he saw the people on Sci-Car for the first time, that he got like...
Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, Cage Match.
What?
Oh, don't worry, nobody saw the third one anyway.
I almost said Mel Brooks and Tina Turner. That would have been a hell of a movie. Do you know that Virginia Hay, the actress who plays Zan, she was in Mad Max 2?
Oh, as what?
Well, I guess as one of the wilderness people.
Makes sense.
But, you know, it's like she was a sexy 6 foot she something person in Australia. Yeah, of course she's going to be cast.
Duh.
We get the showdown, because apparently Crichton, Erin, and Rigel concoct a plan.
They are back in force.
The confrontation with Volme, who insists that they bring the ship down, and he says no.
Bring them to me.
Nah, I don't think so.
And she looked shocked at first. She had no idea that he was.
Yeah, she thought that she had the upper hand. And they show her, they give her a little demonstration. Now, Rigel.
Turns out Rigel's a little bit piss shy.
Yeah. So Dargo and Zan have showed up. Dargo has grabbed the pulse rifle, and he's very upset with his friends for disturbing the contentment of this planet.
Yes.
This is my home now, John. I'm happy here. I will not let you destroy that. If necessary, I will destroy you first.
Things are looking very tense for our heroes and their allies.
Until Rigel gets his bladder under control, does a little neon green stream spurting all over the place, which explode into fireballs upon the impact.
It was very fortunate that he was stationed up there and could do a perfect arc
I
over
suppose
Aaron and
they kind of like worked that out.
I mean, it's a bit of the production thing. They talked about that a lot, how Rigel is a character, but he's also an extremely elaborate and complicated puppet.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So, like, moving him is not as easy as having a person move from room
to
room.
I noticed that earlier in an episode when they're walking from the bar the first time, like, they walk and Rigel's already there and you just kind of walk into shot with him
he's like Frank Drebin's captain in Police Squad, where every time that there's a crime, my boss was already on the scene, like,
yes,
every time, because they've got to set him up. And like, yeah, Rigel can't move around too much, so yeah, he's pissing green. And this is where we finally realize what's happening, because the Tanit root that everyone's been eating, that's been making them slavish, that's been depleting the planet's soil nutrients, that the others, that we know the peacekeepers have been coming back for every 6 months,
can be converted into something or the other oil. What do they call it?
It makes shaken oil.
Chakan oil.
Chakan oil, which is apparently what powers all of the peacekeepers' weapons.
The pulse rifles, yeah. The little yellow bolts of light and the red bolts of light, like those are all apparently like burning high energy wads of oil.
I mean, okay, that makes sense. That would explain the slower than light laser bolts, you know. That's like actually cute little way to
exactly.
Get away with that. Because
it's actually, I mean, I see over your shoulder here now your cat, who was our special guest on the first episode, as you recall, who sometimes has a habit of like licking her tummy a little bit more than she ought to.
Yeah.
And so you're a reminder that you've got the little spray bottle where just sort of squirt a little water over.
Yes.
Which is kind of how these guns were. They're squirt guns.
They're basically flamethrowers, I suppose.
They've got the shotgun. What is a flamethrower except a squirt gun
with an igniter?
True.
And it turns out that like all this production, which is destroying the planet, is like going towards the
Peacekeeper War Machine. Yep. Yeah, very
and
good.
It takes a little bit of convincing, but like for some reason they manage to convince all the people on the planet that they have to stop this, even though the fact that they are still in the thralls of the happy juice.
Yeah. Now, in particular, the person that they needed to convince was Volmay, because at this point, like, she's convinced, she realizes this. Maybe she wasn't in it for herself this whole time after all. Maybe she wanted to get away from here, realizing that she couldn't individually save her
people. Well, she has the worm as well, we're told earlier in the episode.
That's right.
So she's not under the influence of the happy juice. Yeah.
Yeah. They give the others, the peacekeepers, they give the worm to certain people, and she's just a random person that was chosen.
The others simply chose it from the crowd. It could have been any one of us.
So there's a planetary revolution, and everything gets turned around, although we don't actually see how that plays out, but
they know it's going to be difficult. Like the rebels, Tanga's dad, says, you know, we're going to have to learn to fight. We now have ammunition. We know that.
She says, like, I can teach you how to make the oil out of the Tanga root. Tanga root is... No. I keep, like, confusing her name. And
we never see Tanga's root. She's got the hairband. Yeah,
yes. Maybe this oil can also work for, like hydrogen peroxide.
I would not risk it.
No, that's a very good point. And yes, he gets his worm poked out of his...
By Aaron.
Who is quite comfortable. She does a little bit of worm waving, which I noticed that she's like wiggling it like an electric toothbrush or something like that.
Do you know what one of those things is called?
No.
It's called a cat in a bag.
Oh?
It's an animatronic thing. Like Jim Henson's, they have these where sometimes you've got to have like little wiggling worms.
Oh,
and it's
right.
just like an autonomous like armature that just moves around.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can put it in a bag and then it's like there's a cat in
there. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Cat in a bag.
Yeah. I'm surprised if it was anything else than an electric toothbrush or some sort of turny thing at an angle so that it makes this like worm-like movements.
Do you notice how Erin, I mean, she's got the gloves on.
Yeah.
Like now she's full-on scientist. She'll just do some surgery on... She followed the instructions she was given. Yeah, it was easy.
Combat surgery is like, this is probably more her kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Zahn is back to her serene self. I mean, her non-drugged serene self, I suppose.
It's hard to tell sometimes with her, isn't it?
Well, it depends a little bit if she's like actually making sense or just talking happy.
It's an absolutely wonderful place.
Rigel gets another barb in, where he goes like, be warned that I owe you one. And it's like something about venomous reply. And I'm like wondering, okay, what does he owe you? Does he owe you a favor or does he owe you a venomous reply?
Yeah, you're right. Like I was furiously scribbling down every line in that bit because the whole dialogue was great. How about we just listen to the dialogue?
Okay, yeah.
Hey, Rigel.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with her?
Oh, she thinks she's a scientist now. False superiority!
I am not a scientist. I am, however, what I have always been, and that is superior.
If I were warmer, I would have an appropriately venomous reply. Be warned. I owe you one.
Because that whole bit was actually great.
Yep, fantastic. And there's a little bit of Moya's gut gurgling going on in the background.
We see Crichton, who is now recovered, heading toward the door, and Aaron calls him back and advises him, you know...
I'd wait. Let Dargo come to you when he's ready.
Now, at this point, I thought that he was ignoring her advice again, because we see him turning around and walking toward the door. Yeah. I sort of figured he always gets the last word. He always gets the last scene and to sort of look into the distance with melancholy. But no, the last scene is Dargo and Zahn talking about their
experience. Zahn being back to the ship's counselor, and Dargo having had enough of Crimson for a little bit. He's back into his black pajamas.
Oh, his black gi. It looks so good on him. He should wear that all the time. And he talks about how he had two very different... visions for his life when he was a child.
Oh, yes. One is a happy, simple farmer, and the other one is a brave warrior.
And Zahn comes in again with, Only two.
Only two.
Yes, I have, must have had hundreds. And she like basically tells him like neither of these things is something that can just happen. Both have to be worked for.
Yeah.
And worked at, yeah. I suppose, is a better word for it.
Those kinds of dreams cannot be found, brave Luxon. You have to build them. And I promise you, your hands are still strong. And there is plenty of time.
Which I think is maybe like the first time that they're going to have a plan for what they're going to do. Maybe like, yeah, they've been coasting from crisis to crisis, opportunity to opportunity. And now that they've had this experience, like this is a very valuable lesson. Okay, maybe we do need to build it for ourselves.
Maybe we have some goals now rather than just like run from the peacekeepers.
Okay, so let's have a bit of a review of this episode because I noticed that's something that we haven't really done before. So let's think about some of the things that we can
review of the episode.
No, I know, but like we haven't played favorites.
Oh, okay.
Right? Okay, so let's think of some categories that we I've got one. Who in this episode gave you a Woody?
Oh.
And you can interpret that how you like.
Well, I think definitely Volmay gave me a Woody.
Yeah, she gave me a Woody. The heebies and the jeebies.
She was like well played. And yeah, the slow talking.
It's so weird, right?
I didn't notice the blinking, but it probably unconsciously and like it contributes to the weirdness of the character.
I got an actual Woody, I think, from Crichton in his in his Space Aladdin outfit and doing Imhotep.
Yeah.
You know, like it drunk, easily influenced frat boy who may be interested in some things that he wouldn't admit to his buddies, but hey, it's a party, it's Amsterdam.
Went on the planet of the ski hat people to us the temple.
And I loved the train.
I mean, it was just one car, and like we only see it zipping around in the background once, and the rest of it is just a static prop.
It wasn't a prop. It was just there.
Right.
No, but like they went and used this location. This was the first like big location shoot, and the first time also that they had like a lot of extras.
Yes.
Which
all of them conveniently human.
It
makes sense. Like, you know,
you're right there. But like, imagine what it was like for the production crew and for the extras. You've got like 50 people, 50 actors who have done like soap operas, commercials, whatever. Yeah. And they call in, Farscape, it's an American show. Okay, cool, I'll show up. Okay, well, we're just going to have to give you all these ski hats and make you up in maroon. Yeah. And you're going to have to do this sort of spastic Bhangra dance where you sort of, you can just be super weird about it. Oh,
and just like look happy.
And then they came to this location, which is, I believe it was like, it was on the other side of like a Chinese cemetery.
Uh-huh.
It was used as a theater space. And there was this train car there. And the production designer, Ricky Eyre, just went, we're doing that.
Oh, cool. And it was conveniently in the right color, I suppose.
After he painted it, I think.
That makes sense, yeah.
And then that became like they rewrote the script to adapt, like that became the conspiracy train where they could do all their scheming.
And I noticed that most of the outdoor shots involving the train were conveniently framed to not show much of the surroundings.
Yeah, exactly. And they added some CGI because it sort of makes sense that they had this advanced industry. And also, Volmay mentioned my people never aspired to travel the stars.
Oh, yes. But I kind of thought that was a little bit like, of course not. If you're drugged out of your minds and you're not going to aspire to anything.
Oh,
but,
that's true.
That, we have no idea how long this has been going on. Well, not that long because we know that her father... was not Volmay's father, but Tangra's father.
Oh,
Like he used to be a musician or some sorts.
Something
about his hand. So it can't have been like more than 20 and 40 years that this has been going on.
Yeah. And it's been going on in the uncharted territories where the peacekeepers aren't supposed to go.
Yes. And that's where they apparently do go. So that's a little bit. Some of their supplies.
Did you have any other moments that really stood out for you?
I
mean, you're on a quest to find out what the relationship is between Pilot.
Yeah,
and
so that was an interesting little tidbit. It rules out a few options and it suggests strongly towards some others. But like, we still know very little concrete about it, other than that the pilot and the ship are bonded.
Yeah,
but we still know very little about the nature of that bond.
We learn a little bit more about Zan that prior to her imprisonment, she was self-described a savage.
Savage, capable of anything.
I can't really picture her as savage, right? I mean, how that would go.
I mean, we saw her slam the staple head against the kid from Thrown for a Loss.
Right, she has it when it counts.
And threatened to rip his arm off.
I mean, she has it where it counts in many ways, but
she most certainly does. Favorite, like, costumes or design? I mean,
it was all a bit bland. Everybody was wearing red, you know, it's like, and I mean, the hats were cute and the, you know, everybody having white hair and all like that. So that was kind of interesting to see. But other than that, the city was very, like, industrial look.
It is kind of monoculture in more than one way.
The city reminded me most of, I think, Equilibrium. It's like a little bit the same feeling, like
the bare sort of stark concrete.
Yeah,
and,
very brutal, you know, very brutalist, brutalistic. Yeah, brutalist. That's the word. Yeah,
yeah. It is a bit of a Planet of the Nice Hats, where everyone has the same sort of culture and. But yeah, it's sort of like in this case, it kind of makes sense because they all have the same like environmental pressure on them, and their culture has kind of stopped because it's always Friday.
Yeah. Oh God. Took me way too long to figure out the name of the episode, how that tied into there, mainly because I forgot it almost straight away.
It's another bit of a time loop episode, similar to
the last one.
So, did you enjoy it?
It was a great episode. I liked it. Yeah,
they all are. Aren't
yeah,
they?
It's very good. Show's really going strong,
and it's really finding its feet, especially in the next episode. So next week. There's a bit of a spoiler. I know that you're going to announce it in just a second.
Right.
That's episode 7. That is the episode that is widely regarded as the moment that Farscape really found its voice.
Okay.
When Farscape became what it was going to be, where it would evolve from there. But the experimental phase had finally succeeded.
I'm already looking forward to it.
And that's the story so far, Farscape.
We'll see you next week with episode 107, PK Tech Girl, where the hulk of the legendary peacekeeper ship, the Zelbinon, holds a pleasant surprise for Crichton. But Rigel must confront the time spent on the ship where he was tortured by the sadistic commander, Captain Durka,
ooh,
while the crew work to reactivate the ship's shields to defend themselves from an attack.
I can't wait. You can find us on SoFarscape at Twitter and Facebook. I've got to get better at it. You can find us at SoFarscape on Twitter and Facebook and on SoFarscape.com. I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay.
So Farscape, so good.